Now when I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, well, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time you stop rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they marched me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amidst all the cheers, the flag waving and tears, we sailed off for Gallipoli. And how well I remember that terrible day, how our blood stained the sand and the water, and of how in that hell that they called Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was waiting, he'd primed himself well. He showered us with bullets and he rained us with shell, and in 5 minutes flat he'd blown us all to hell. Nearly blew us right back to Australia. But the band played Waltzing Matilda when we stopped to bury our slain. We buried ours and the Turks buried theirs. Then we started all over again. And those that were left, well, we tried to survive in that mad world of blood, death and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big Turkish shell knocked me arse overhead, and when I woke up in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, well, I wished I was dead. Never knew there was worse things than dying, for I'll go no more waltzing Matilda all around the green bush far and free, to hum tents and pegs, a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me. So they gathered the crippled, the wounded, the maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The legless, the armless, the blind, the insane, those proud wounded heroes of Suvla. And as our ship pulled into Circular Quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thank Christ there was nobody waiting for me. To grieve, to mourn, and to pity. But the band played Waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway. But nobody cheered, they just stood and stared. Then they turned all their faces away. And so now, every April, I sit on me porch and I watch the parade pass before me. And I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, reviving old dreams of past glories. And the old men march slowly, all bones stiff and sore. They're tired old heroes from a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. But the band plays Waltzing Matilda, and the old men still answer the call. But as year follows year, more old men disappear. Someday no one will march there at all. Waltzing Matilda, Waltzing Matilda, who'll come waltzing Matilda with me? And their ghosts may be heard as they march by that billabong. Come a waltzing Matilda with me.
Hello, good to talk to you. The moment we have arrived at in this unusual semester is so important, I think, because it is a turning point in your educational lives, that I want to continue talking today about the subjects raised in my supplemental talk last week. But it would also be desirable to cast a little bit of attention on the Folklore of Capitalism, which we'll discuss on Wednesday. I do think there is more to be said about Robinson and about criminal defense as a subject of your possible professional interest, but I'm actually now minded to read a little bit more in Lawyerland and to meet Carl Wiley before we come back to talking about Robinson. The Folklore of Capitalism is a book that plainly speaks the mind of 1937 and of one of Franklin Roosevelt's most creative and interesting policy interlocutors. You will, of course, care most about Thurman Arnold because his last name, Arnold, is in the front of Arnold and Porter, and indeed he was one of the founders of that now titanic DC firm where so many people think they might like to work. His memoir, Fair Fights and Foul, may not be quite as powerful as the autobiography of Clarence Darrow, The Story of My Life, that one was called, and Arnold's career maybe is not quite as fascinating as that of Thurgood Marshall, who left no memoir behind. But if you want to read about how a person created a pathway through the law that capitalized on the outsider status of being from Laramie, Wyoming, and the insider status of knowing how the New Deal was put together and what it means to be a contrarian thinker in a world of conformist institutions, then Fair Fights and Foul might be a thing you'd want to take a look at. But the folklore of 1937, for all that it is in one sense time-bound, and is the folklore of 1937 as much as it is the folklore of capitalism, the folklore of capitalism is for us an answer in part to a question in part. What would happen if we applied the ideas of legal realism to politics? That is to say, if we tried to treat politics as a world in which things are what they do, not what they're called. It is, from that point of view, I must say, endlessly interesting. Most of the time in the 21st century when I have taught this book, it has seemed that the first and most important thing to point out is that its author doesn't know that the Second World War will happen, or what the Third Reich will turn into in both fact and American understanding. When it was written in late 1936, Kristallnacht had not happened yet, and the real meaning of Nazi anti-Semitism hadn't become apparent, nor had the determination to extirpate the Romani Rai through the genocide of the Roma population, another part of the story of what happened in the war. But most importantly, of course, the war itself, the immense alteration of not just America as a polity, but America in its role in the world, that the war against Germany and Japan would bring. So most of the time when I find myself setting out to preface discussion of this book, I find myself acting to remind people that that its judgments, which may confuse them, are judgments made in an era before what we take to be the founding of our past, let alone our present. In the period between January of 2017 and the day before yesterday, the folklore of capitalism had a somewhat different value as we tried to understand how the collapse of the Republican Party under Donald Trump happened. It was apparent that it happened before the election of 2020. But efforts to understand the ways in which not just the Republican Party, but also the Democratic Party were challenged by fundamental changes in circumstances in which old political organizations were becoming obsolete was sharply focused by this apparently ancient book. And now, in the aftermath of the end of the Trump presidency, in the insurrection in the Capitol and the rise of QAnonification within the Republican Party, even more interesting and surprising elements arise. It would be useful, and I think it probably will turn out to feel to you all on the pads in days to come like an obvious effort to try to apply Thurman Arnold's thinking quite directly to the chaotic circumstances of now, in which, of course, it does indeed have confusing and baffling and self-contradictory forms of application that are well worth scrutinizing. As usual, the point about his ideas is not whether they are right or wrong in this context. They were not thought for in this context, much as the United States Constitution wasn't, but rather what they can lead us to. And they can, if you happen to be wanting to write a paper about contemporary politics and law in some other course, or maybe even a brief op-ed style essay in this course, they have plenty to offer, his ideas do. But I want actually, in opening this book, to apply its insights in a different way, closer to the way of 1937, or closer, for that matter, to the way of 1900, when Thurman Arnold was a pup in Wyoming. Because really, though this is an effort to apply realist ideas to politics, it is also, and more intimately to its author, an effort to do something else, to explore what I guess we could call a lawyer's theory of social organization. That is, to apply ideas of sociology and social psychology available at the end of the first third of the 20th century for the first time to problems that are precedent to what lawyers need to think about when they think about society, namely, who are these entities that populate social life and that cause us to use our theory of social action as we watch them behave and as we watch them interact with entities outside the society and with individual human beings. The relevance of this to our work, aside from being a kind of lawyer's theory of social psychology and sociology with some of the present in it, the most important aspect of our work is that Thurman Arnold is attempting to build a lawyer's theory of social organization on top of the very powerful and vexing idea that we call Freud, namely that the majority of human mental activity is unconscious. Arnold's fundamental proposition, when you take his plain country lawyer from the West form of vocabulary out of it, Arnold's primary proposition is that at the level of social psychology, the influence of minds upon minds, and at the level of social organization, where people come together and the influence of their minds on one another's minds makes organized behavior that can become embedded in institutions, that is, practices and structures that are durable over time, the most important aspects of human psychological life to take into account are unconscious ones. This, then, is a Freudian and Darwinian theory of the psychology of social organization for lawyers, made by a man at the end of the first third of the 20th century who didn't know the rest of the history that was coming, but who has something very powerful to say, not only about how the American administrative state and post-war capitalism were organized, but something to say which helps us to understand social organizations for ourselves in the present 21st century environment, which bears a number of historical correspondences to the world of 1937, which are indeed surprising. The primary reason that I ask you to read not only chapter 2 of The Folklore of Capitalism, but chapters 1 and 3 as well, is to put in his founding context those ideas about how organizations work, that they contain creeds, that is, internally contradictory, broadly non-factual statements about the nature of an organization and its purpose, which intermediate between a series of structures that keep that organization together in practice and the large historical understanding that stretches all the way back to the culture heroes, saints, and gods of the society, which gives every organization a place in what we could think of as the social cosmology, the largest possible picture of who we are. Whether that's the particular way in which the automobile companies relate themselves to the great American experiment, from Engine Charlie Wilson's view that what's good for General Motors is good for the United States in the Eisenhower administration to Lee Iacocca's version of the Frank Sinatra version of corporate leadership in a company that makes muscle cars. Lee Iacocca, if you go back and look at his 80s screed, is actually in large measure the template for the Donald Trump businessman character created by The Apprentice and stretches all the way back to the large individuals of the John D. Rockefeller type that Thurman Arnold knows as the personification of capitalism. Or, for that matter, the Mary Barra-led General Motors that was last week announcing its entire electrification, its end of the internal combustion engine, and its participation in the soon-to-be-formed Great American Narrative of how we invented our way out of climate change. The creeds, then, those internal contradictory and false structures that allow an organization to have a legendary, mythological sense of its origins and an idealistic but nonetheless broad enough to accommodate everybody who needs to be part of it view of its essence, of its character, from Arnold's point of view, is joined to unconscious propositions that he calls attitudes, which are the mechanisms by which the organization, whatever form of organization it is, defines otherness, outsiderness, separates the who we are from the who we are not, and operates to expel, ostracize, neutralize, silence, shut up, sit upon, oppress, or whatever form of word you want to use to indicate the nature of the process of social othering, which others, those who within the organization do not adequately participate in the creed, and who are to one extent or another therefore undermined as individuals by unconscious responses in other individuals around them, in order to maintain the coherence of the organization. The behavior of state Republican committees busily censoring those in the Republican Party, whether of the Liz Cheney, Ben Sass, or other types who have dared to propose that an organized attack on the United States Congress incited by the President of the United States for the purpose of reversing a free and fair election that he lost is unworthy of the approval of the Republican Party is an example, of course, of attitudes in action. No doubt people regard themselves in this as conscious, but to say that they are conscious is to adopt a hypothesis in which large numbers of people not actually involved, the onlookers and the bystanders of society, are not perfectly sure that they agree. The attitudes which allow an organization to attain coherence, those unconscious ideations and obsessive behaviors which police the boundaries and distinguish the us from the them, are, from Arnold's point of view, accompanied by another set of highly important unconscious human behaviors, the ones he calls habits, which make it possible for organizations to function because human beings know unconsciously how to cooperate with one another and can behave like other social animals, termites or ants or bees, in achieving the goal of the superorganism that is their social life without having to be each consciously deciding how that is to occur. The principle that if we had to figure out every single day how to get food into and garbage out of New York City, the city would fail, but we all have unconscious habits of a cooperative structure that allow us to run the metabolism of our city is at the moment challenged, as you see. What we have watched in the conditions of the epidemic is the need for various forms of social cooperation to be made conscious, at which point they begin to fail because they only work unconsciously. When they are brought into consciousness and people are asked consciously to understand their habits in relation to one another in order to permit cooperation, the ethnomethodology, as the social science calls it, of how to walk down the street or shop in a store, suddenly upended by the inability of people unconsciously to adopt the recognition that they need to wear masks. If you contrast the mask problem in the United States over the last year with, for example, E.O. Wilson's beautiful little studies of how ants remove dead ants from the hill and what happens when a living ant is erroneously marked chemically as a dead one, it will reveal how important Arnold's insight is. Social organization at the level at which we actually experience it from moment to moment and day to day absolutely depends upon the unconscious human mind, to which the conscious human mind often creates potentially existentially worrisome obstacles. This form of the understanding of the social psychology of human organizations is so important that one might even want to save it from the enormous productive complexity and self-contradictory nature of Arnold's arguments about American politics and systems of government. And I offer you his concluding chapter on political dynamics as an opportunity to consider the borderland between the two forms of thought going on in the folklore of capitalism that are immediately but conflictingly of interest to us. That is to say, on the one hand, what happens when one actually tries to think about human social organizations as largely the outcome of unconscious rather than conscious mental processes, as one actually brings to politics an understanding of why it is that we get a lump in our throat when we watch the parade, and why it is that the behavior of human societies is harder to understand when its organizational sophistication is taken as a sign of its conscious brilliance, than if we understand why Australian young people, men, of course, in this instance, were put through blood, hell, and slaughter on a Turkish beach at the opening of the First World War by that immense, just endless human fuck up called Winston Churchill, who seems to have become now a hero not only of the last generation of pre-European English people, and also apparently to the American Republican Party, whatever that is. But why? That is to say, not why Winston Churchill, or why the fuck-up, or why the blood, hell, and slaughter that was Gallipoli, but rather, why are they marching? Which is, in the end, in the beautiful, tragic poetry of that understanding of Waltzing Matilda, that is, and the band played Waltzing Matilda, the real question: why does the band, and what are they marching for? And to give that largely a conscious answer is to lose one valuable component of a lawyer's theory of social action, which is a recognition of the importance of the idea we call Freud to a lawyer's theory not only of the individual intrapsychic psychology of the human beings with whom we deal, but also of the organizations with which every single day, in the process of making things happen using words in society, we are intimately dealing. Our sense of how organizations cohere is necessarily precedent for those of you who want to ask, how am I going to make change, to making change. And Arnold's theory of political change, which is certainly embedded in his understanding of the folklore of 1937, whether you agree with it or not, is an important interlocutor for your own. That is to say that the process of making change is the process of dealing with organizations not at the level of their rationality, but at the level of their unconscious personalities. That may seem, in some sense, at odds with an idea of what it means to be a personality, because corporations, agencies, courts, and so on are plural, containing many individuals. But as we shall see in 2 weeks when we begin to think about it, that problem of plurality exists within the supposedly integral individual, just as it exists in the supposed plenitude of the persons making up, whether it is the New York Yankees or Columbia Law School or the United States Senate, an unconsciously coherent organization made, well, as events can show, psyches held together by unconscious glue with which they attempt to ride out existentially challenging situations, largely through a process of trying to make the situations disappear. We'll talk about some aspects of this on the pads of Monday and Wednesday of this week. I'm sure we won't get to all of them, and I look forward to talking to you in other contexts as we begin to try and bring some small group meetings into our weekly schedule, and as you raise issues in office hours and in the essays that you will soon be writing. Thurman Arnold has more to contribute than he needs to be discussed in that sense. When I first made this course many a year ago, one of my distinguished colleagues, now departed from the institution and from the world, stopped into my office one Friday afternoon to say that he had to take an airplane ride that afternoon, and he had heard that my teaching materials in the new course, then called Perspectives in Modern Legal Thought, were interesting, and could I lend him a reader? And so I handed him a book of photocopied reprints from the various things which happened in those days, as they do now, to include both Felix Cohen and Thurman Arnold, the first volume of The Reader, as it then was. And off he went. And on Monday afternoon, he walked into my office with the reader I had lent him for his airplane reading on the Friday, and he dropped it loudly on the desk from a height, boom, and said, "Too much Thurman Arnold." And he turned around and marched out of my office, and I thought to myself, thank you, Kenny. That demonstrates that there is the perfect amount of Thurman Arnold in here. It is meant not only to annoy you in that sense, but also to continue to annoy you after you have stopped officially reading or thinking about it with me. It is, in that sense, a book to continue having indigestion about long after having first eaten of it. Which is why, having said only half an hour of tedious things about this book, I'm going to leave the subject now. We will come back to it in our work this week and still, I guess, at the beginning of next. But I want, for the remainder of my time with you in this file, to go back to the question of where we are in not the history of this school. I personally don't think that you or I should care, or even where we are in the history of the epidemic, because the answer to that question is we are in the middle. But rather, where we are in the first year of your legal education, and also in the first year of your practice, which is truly the most important subject that we confront in this meltdown of institutions, habits, and attitudes through which we are presently passing, thanks to the psychological and sociological effects of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. As I was saying in the supplementary audio I recorded at the end of last week, you probably cannot tell what is happening on the other side of the social process called teaching and learning in the law school at the moment. Like all other issues of social action, like all other matters of strategy construction, like all other lawyers' analysis of what is going on out there, the single most important thing to do is also the hardest, which is to put aside your own and your client's understanding of what is going on in order to make judgments about what other parties in the social processes you're part of think and understand and believe about where they are. When I say that the two most important working parts of creativity are presence and absence, I am in part invoking that principle. If you are to make good use of your lawyer's theory of social action, if you are to understand how to make things happen in society using words, if you are, let us get all highfalutin and bullshit about it, if you are to create justice, then it is true that, like all other creators, you must be both present and absent in proportionate measure. To be present is to understand and alertly to be constantly learning and resynthesizing your view of the social situations in which you are, with your client's needs and your existing strategy and tactical plans in place. Present, in that sense, means not driving by remote, not thinking that you've got a copy already in the filing cabinet you can just mark up when the time comes, not thinking that you know the client well enough, even if you've only just met and she or he is still lying to you. But you also need to be absent from that to in which you are most present, that is to say, in the relationship with the client and in your view of the needs and threats, challenges, and possibilities in the circumstances, because to absent yourself from your own position is the precursor to being capable of imagining the presence of the other, what they want, what they think, what they understand. Whether that's the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, sitting in the White House in October of 1962, trying to understand what Nikita Khrushchev thinks, and how their joint maneuvering, or rather their adversary maneuvering, over ships in the mid-Atlantic bringing missiles to Cuba will affect the fate of every single human being in at least the Northern Hemisphere within days. or whether that is a criminal defense practitioner pondering whether this month or next will be the better time to get the most advantageous possible plea deal out of the prosecutor, or whether it is the act of sitting in a labor negotiation trying to understand where the bluster and weight throwing on the other side of the table will open up a sign of a zone of possible agreement on a contentious point which is holding up the negotiation as a whole. The process of understanding the other is absolutely crucial, cannot be dispensed with, is really, really difficult, and marks on most occasions the good lawyer from the great one. Now, in the present moment, understanding what's on the other side of you in law school, the thing you call the administration, which is quite a name for what is really just a handful of individuals led by a single animating intelligence, the dean, responsible to a theoretically sovereign but fundamentally loose-limbed entity called the faculty, which is now really just a bunch of folks on Zoom, trying to understand how both your teachers individually and the institution collectively are operating in an environment in which their unconscious habits, attitudes, and creeds don't work, at least partially, is difficult for you while you cope with the immense anxiety of the current moment, which is compounded of the usual anxieties of second semester law students with which I am familiar, stretching back more than a generation and a half, but which is also the consequence of your own social situations, relative social isolation, maybe even absolute social isolation, but certainly deeply, disturbingly different level of social isolation than that with which you were familiar before the epidemic, and which has characterized all your interactions with the institutions and practices, habits, creeds, and attitudes of the law school, which in some fundamental sense you've never really seen. Under those circumstances, it is very difficult for you to see even a millimeter over the horizon of the self-presentation of the organization called the law school and its sub-organizations, like, for example, the Office of Career Services. To understand what other people are thinking, it would have been good to see them. It would have been good to work with them. It would have been good to understand their creeds, habits, and attitudes as they stood before the epidemic, and then it would be useful to understand the distortions that none of us can fully grasp because we're only living in one apartment, and all over the place are other conscious and unconscious things happening to the people with whom you deal in the process of understanding your education now. With some of that, I cannot help. I haven't seen these people either. I have been for now more than 325 days in isolation in my apartment, and even those whom I have known for decades have experienced forces acting psychically and socially upon them of which I have no ken. But that doesn't mean that I can't see a little bit further over the snowy horizon of the present than you can. At least I have done it many, 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 many times before. I am, of course, going as usual to waste my analytic efforts by trying to concentrate on two unimportant things, grades and jobs, which you take enormously seriously, on the belief that they are what really matters and that any analysis of the current situation should begin with them. I am wasting my time, first of all, because they are not what really matter. What really matters is your learning and your attitude towards your learning. And I am wasting my time because when I pay attention to the things that are not important that you think are important, and I try to talk about them realistically, that is, in due respect for their unimportance, you are duty-bound to resist, because the creeds, attitudes, and habits you have absorbed already, which allow you to be a law student, even though law school barely exists, compel you to an unconscious resistance to the idea that what is put so sharply before you as the most important thing that you are doing right now is actually not. But I do need, once again, to start there, because as you all say to me on the pads, in the journals, in office hours, you are indeed awfully, powerfully affected by a series of ideas about grades and about jobs, which are harming you, interfering with your learning, making it difficult to enjoy your learning, therefore making it difficult for you to know whether you like being in law school enough that you ought to continue being in law school, and are entirely obscuring from you the large questions about what kind of law you would be happy practicing and how to prepare yourself to practice that kind of law, which it is now important in the second term of law school, after you have finished your conversational law talk by immersion semester last, to begin to try to understand. So I need to start again with the things that do not matter and to explain why they seem to you to matter very much incorrectly. Let's start with grades, and let's start with the grades you already have. I hear from people every spring, and I hear, therefore, from people more this spring, which is tenser than usual, I hear an awful lot of tension and anxiety over the straight B's I got, or the straight B pluses that I got, or whatever it is that is straightly depressing you. So let us begin with what it is that the grades earned in the first term of law school are about. I will again simply state what is my factual basis for judgment. I have now spent 33 years minus a term or two when I was on leave teaching second-term law students, thousands of them. And I have therefore read thousands of first-semester transcripts. And I see an awful lot of the transcripts that you just have seen for the first time, the ones that come from being graded in the first semester of law school. So let me begin by explaining to you that the vast preponderance of first semester transcripts show the same grade, plus or minus one half of a grade in every course. The straight this or the straight that is by far the modal first semester transcript. That's an important fact you can't see because you've got one, not thousands, from which to judge. Why is it so common that you get all one of this, whatever this may be, in the first year courses? Well, if you see a bunch of supposedly independent measurements which all come out the same way, then probably they're not independent measurements. They're measuring the same thing, even if they don't seem to be measuring the same thing. And in first semester transcripts, that's the case. As I have explained, the first term of law school is conversational law talk by immersion. It's a language acquisition education process, like doing a summer of first conversational French or German at Middlebury. You show up and everybody makes you use German or French until such time as it has insinuated its way into your existing structures of neurological conduct. brain matter does German now. In the same way, then, the first semester of law school presents a situation in which, if you measure so-called academic performance, what you're actually measuring is speed of language acquisition, uptake rate of conversational law talk. Before I went to law school, in the many wise things that Morty Horowitz told me, he told me this. He told me there will come one day when the light goes on. That's the moment at which, in the language acquisition process, you actually can begin to converse in the new language without conscious translation back and forth. In language acquisition structure, if you land in a new society and have to learn its language from zero at the get-go, the light going on moment is the moment when you find that you are dreaming in the new language. What is happening when you begin dreaming in the new language is you no longer need conscious translation activity, front right, if you want to sort of know where the pole would have to be pushed into your skull in order to touch it. You are no longer using cerebral cortex in a conscious mode to translate from English or your other first language back and forth to the new one. You have new neural stacks capable of manufacturing grammar and semantics in the new language, and in your dreams you are speaking. Maybe you are speaking, but you think in your dream unconsciously that you are thinking in the new thing. If that happens, if the light goes on, if there is a sense of internal consolidation of linguistic competence in October, then you get A's when the measurement is conducted at the end of the term. If that process occurs in November, you get B's when the measurement occurs at the end of the term. But everybody gets there, slow or fast. You're going to be a lawyer for many decades, 5, 6, for all I know more. It will never actually matter at all whether the speed of linguistic uptake at the beginning of law school meant that the light went on in October of 2020 or in November or December of 2020. That's what those first semester grades mean, but that measurement is meaningless. It's an example of the fallacy of mensuration, the belief that what can be counted is what counts. The measurement, which is surprisingly uniform, as I say, pretty much everybody comes to pretty much the same conclusion about each individual student, no matter how different the courses may be, the measurement itself, though apparently precise, is useless, has no long-term value, and says nothing about how it is that you should think about yourself as a student or how you should organize your work. I am always aware of students who have gotten what they consider to be disappointing grades in the first semester of law school. They think that they should have learned the language faster, as though that mattered, and who therefore feel that whatever the mode of studying and learning was that they used in the first semester of law school, it was the wrong one. I can't do it that way because, look, I got B plus or B or B minus. And of course, this is an erroneous conclusion from a technical point of view. If you really wanted to say whether that judgment can be sustained on the evidence, you would have to say it can. The way you learn didn't determine how quick you were on the linguistic uptake. That has to do with other things like age. I was quick at learning languages before I was 12. After that, it got slower. Now, it's really, really hard. But also, there are inborn facilities. My nephew, Dylan, who began his life as a bilingual person with an English-speaking parent and a French-speaking parent, is a gifted learner of languages. His brother Pierre, who grew up in the same situation, is also highly capable in both English and French, and one of the best schmoozers I have ever seen, at least when it comes to the people he likes schmoozing, who are the people who cook in and run restaurants. But Pierre's linguistic facility and Dylan's are different. They also, as it turns out, are different when it comes to computer programming and so on in different ways. That is to say, we are neurologically different, but the way that you should study is by the time you've been working as a trick-performing pony in the educational system and succeeding at it, as all of you have for years, the way you work is already accessible to you. And nothing in the supposedly important measurement conducted by law school in the first term has told you anything about it. First semester grades are a precise measurement of an irrelevant quantity, and they are literally meaningless and should be ignored. This is why at the Yale Law School, where so many of your teachers were gestated, the pass-fail first semester is an article of faith. When we reformed the first-year curriculum in 1988, in my second year as a teacher in this institution, the whole of the reform, now almost all taken apart again piece by piece, the whole of the reform was to be voted on by the faculty as a block in order to allow legislation to occur. And the only piece of the package which was independently taken apart was the curricular reform proposal for a pass-fail first semester at Columbia. This was taken out on the floor of the faculty and, quote, tabled, close quote, which means in the subsequent 33 years it has never been discussed again. The pass-fail first semester is a good idea because the grades that are otherwise given are literally meaningless and should be ignored, but it's very hard to ignore them if they're given, that is to say, imposed on you. And their imposition is a dreadful error. Each of you can reverse that error permanently and completely for yourselves, and nobody else can do it. I have just tried. You can feel already how little I have succeeded. But of course, you are told, the second semester grades, now those are really important. I suspect that you have seen the movie of The Paper Chase, and therefore I suspect that you have seen the hero's journey from naivete to completeness summarized in that paper airplane of the first year grades flying off the cliff into the ocean, and you didn't believe it. And perhaps you shouldn't, I don't know. I will speak for myself. I came to law school in the fall of 1980, and I spent an entire year in law school because law school loves the first year to be integral, before primarily spending my second year in New Haven doing the coursework for my PhD in the history department. But in addition to the coursework beginning graduate school, I also took a couple of courses in the law school in the fall of 1981, partly because I wanted to continue working with Joseph Goldstein to take his crimes course, and partly because I didn't feel, well, that graduate school would be thrilling, and I didn't like law school very much, and I thought combining the two might be better than suffering either one of them alone. So I was in and out of the law school every single day in the fall of my second year. I was in graduate school, at least in theory, most of the time, and I had a living to earn working on making computer programs for IBM so I could pay the bills for law school and, what have you. And therefore, I was busy. And I didn't get around to looking at my second semester law school grades until Christmas time of 1981, three terms into law school, in the middle of what we would now call my second year. Oh, how could you do that? Because you must have needed them for jobs, but I wasn't looking for jobs. I had made one effort to get one job in the first year of law school. I wrote to a fellow who practiced criminal defense law, whom I thought well of, Michael Tiger, and asked him for a job, and he said yes, and then said no. But I didn't really expect to get that job. I did expect to spend my first year's summer working at IBM, making computer programs and getting paid for it, as I had been doing before. And because I didn't actually, therefore, officially seek summer employment, I had no need for my second semester grades, and I didn't need to know what they were. When I went to look at them in December, after my first year was over and my second year, though it was really my first year in graduate school, was halfway through, I wasn't terribly surprised by them. They were grades that I thought were reasonable given the work that I had turned in and what I thought I had done. I wasn't shocked or disappointed or surprised or overwhelmed or gratified. They were, yeah, what they were. Which, if you didn't look at your grades from this term until next Christmas, would be the same experience for you. You would be neither shocked nor surprised. Of course, you're not going to do that, because how could we possibly ignore our second term grades when they are so important? Bullshit. But what can I do? You won't believe me no matter what I say. Your grades this term will not be the same in every course again. Your grades are not the measure of a single quantity distributed through the hands of several different teachers thinking of their courses as distinct. Now, they are different, and they will reflect something about the work you've done, but you also understand that they will reflect nothing about how you would have worked if you had not been working in the epidemic. They are, in that sense, measurements of your ability to do something you don't quite understand yet how to do under conditions which neither you nor your teachers have ever previously experienced and which nobody understands yet how to do well. I would say, as you are well aware, that my colleagues who improvised a way to deal with the epidemic without spending 7.5 years thinking about it first have mostly gotten the wrong idea, hence Zoom school. But it doesn't really matter whether Zoom school is a good idea or a bad idea, or whether it can be better supplemented by what I am doing, because, of course, nobody thinks that you give a damn what my grades are. Everything is supposed to depend upon the reality and importance of a measurement which nobody thinks can be reliable under current circumstances. Hence, the particularities of your enormous concern about the curve, since it is obvious that no absolute measurement makes any sense at the moment, and you assume that any effort to distribute your performance across a normal will involve some profound unfairness, since, after all, even relative standing in the world of the epidemic cannot possibly be related to any underlying qualities that precede or will follow your life in the epidemic. It is obviously simply randomizing. Well, not quite. I mean, I'm sure you understand that there are ways in which one could link what you are doing to how you are feeling in the process of the epidemic, in addition to how you are feeling in all the usual and therefore standardizable dislocating experiences of law school. But in order to do that, people would have to talk to you all the time about how you're feeling, about what you're learning, and how the epidemic is affecting you. And for that, they would have to have journals, and you would have to be keeping them, and they would have to be reading them and writing in them with you and talking to you about them. And while I know that that is possible, I do not think that in most courses, indeed all courses, but this course, it is likely. So, whatever it is that second semester grades are generally supposed to be really importantly about, they're not about. These grades should also be ignored. Oh, but we can't possibly ignore the grades because the jobs. because the jobs. So here we are now at the jobs. But there's really nothing in that either, okay? I know,
but the administration is telling us we need to apply to 15 places. And
the administration, in this concept, actually means two things. The Office of Career Services and the ranking algorithm of U.S. News and World Reports. The Office of Career Services contains dedicated and thoughtful people doing their job. And nothing that I say here means that doing their job is not what they ought to do. But let us be clear, they are measured not on the question of how your learning is going, and not on the question of how you're feeling about how your learning is going. They are measured on the question of how many jobs people are getting. Naturally, therefore, the Office of Career Services is very worried about your summer job. Whatever happens to you in your first year job might have something to do with whatever happens to you in your second year job, which might have something to do with whether you are employed at graduation, which is a crucial variable in the U.S. News and World Report ranking of the law school, which is something that the dean has to see as part of her job. Well, doesn't have to, but does, because no dean of Columbia Law School has ever satisfactorily managed to wrench her or his head out of the situation long enough to declare that we don't want to have a U.S. News and World Report ranking, and fuck you, U.S. News and World Report, which would be a very good idea. But it's important to understand that if other people are worrying about your summer job, that doesn't mean you have to worry about your summer job. You don't. They worry about the summer job because that's what they're rated on. But you're not rated on your summer job. Rating isn't what's important. What's important is law school providing good learning for you? Are you enjoying learning in law school? Should you return to law school to enjoy doing more of it? Are you figuring out how to be the kind of lawyer you would like to be? And while a summer job may be helpful for that, it is one not required in order for you to do well in law school, or to do well in evaluating your own learning and your pleasure in learning and whether you should come back and what kind of lawyer you want to be. It's not required. I know that. I didn't do one. And in the years that I have watched thousands of people pass through law school, whether people had a good summer job or a bad summer job, or whether they had no summer job in their first year of law school, was not important. What was important was how they felt when they came back. How they felt about themselves as law students, how they felt about law school as a place to spend their time, how they felt about the fact that it was an expensive education for most of them, and they had to borrow a bunch of money in order to do it. How they cared about justice or injustice. What they felt they needed to do in order to lead fulfilling lives as justice workers, and whether they thought they could get there from here. Summer jobs sometimes made that all much better because they found something out over there that mattered to them, and summer jobs often made it worse because they felt that they were destined for soulless large law firm employment would pay them amounts of money that they thought they couldn't get any other way, but would require them to live lives they didn't really want to live, all of which is also bullshit, but it felt like that to them, and thus it was hurtful. I have no idea whether if it were my job to be the Office of Career Services and to worry primarily about whether you would be employed at graduation, I would care more about your first year summer jobs. I can't tell. I can put myself in their position. I can understand how they think, but that doesn't mean that I can imagine having their view of the world. It's a little like trying to figure out how I would be if I were into QAnon. Because I don't actually care whether you're employed at graduation. That's a thing that U.S. News and World Report cares about. I care whether you have a good practice at graduation. Whether you understand both what kind of lawyer to be and how to be that kind of lawyer. Whether you know that the decisions that you make are merely provisional and you can always change them. Whether you understand what the enormous social privilege is of having a law license and being able to make your practice be whatever you need it to be at whatever time in your life you need to change your practice in. That's what's important. Some first summer work will make that very much easier for you to understand, because you'll meet people who will help you think about it, whom you will trust, because they're not law professors, they are lawyers. And some summer jobs will inevitably set you back enormously on that pathway, because they will demoralize you or disillusion you or confirm you in the sense that the job is destiny and you have to surrender to employment. And truthfully, what matters most is your conception of your objectives, not your conception of means. Summer jobs are means. They're means to collect a little money to offset the debt. But by the time you have a fully fledged law license, you can collect money to offset the debt whenever you want to by doing whatever it is that's good for you. And summer jobs are a deflection from the task of asking yourself what kind of lawyer you want to be, unless you happen to be working around lawyers who convey important information on that subject, which is not by any means guaranteed to be true. It doesn't matter to whether you are going to come back well and happy and be good law students and build good pre-practices for yourselves before you leave here what you do this summer. And if you sat on the end of the dock in a place where, even though the epidemic was still going on, you didn't have to feel confined all the time and read books you've always wanted to read, I would be just as convinced that you were going to come back in good order and be well as if you had the job you now think you really need and totally want. So there we are. We're not going to agree about this, because you're going to continue to think, not surprisingly, given what Thurman Arnold would say to you about how you came to be part of the organization called law school, you're going to think in terms which are unconsciously built out of the attitudes and the creeds and the habits of the institution you have joined, even though it's the epidemic and the physical presence of the institution is nil and everything is being conjured over Zoom, which is a conjuring tool of great inutility and friction. And yet still, you have become part of the structures of habituated and unconscious thought which are leaving you anxious. I mean, really anxious. I mean, desperately anxious. Now, on the other side are the teachers whose work isn't working. They know this. At the beginning of the summer, when the epidemic's onset in full brought us the April death toll in New York City and the certainty that nothing would work for months and months to come, I told my staff at Software Freedom Law Center that Zoom school would collapse in March of 2021, because the neurological damage done by video conference teaching would accumulate, and by halfway through the second term of nothing but, it would fall apart. And as you see, I was wrong. It collapsed not in March, but in February. Now they're all looking for tricks. 33 years I've worked in this institution, and last week, in 24 hours, for the first time, from zero to hero, we have on the faculty a thing called the teaching committee. We've never had a teaching committee before. It won't actually turn out to be a vast world-beating teaching committee, I can assure you. But the fact that there's a teaching committee means that for the first time, complacency about the adequacy of teaching has bottomed out. Like a car on a dirt road suddenly smacking its belly on the ground. Zoom school has proven to be not okay. And the reason that they know it's not okay is they don't feel it's okay. They too have fatigue up the wazoo. But they're only doing a couple of hours a week of Zoom classes, maybe 7, maybe 10, if they're really working hard like me. But they're spending an awful lot of time in bloviation ceremonies and faculty hiring crap. So their Zoom fatigue is different, of course, from a student's. But still, they know that it doesn't work. And more importantly, they can see that you're all redlining. That the levels of stress and hostility and doubtfulness about the worthiness of this all have reached an absolute limit. And they don't know what to do about that. They're hoping, as I say, that there are tricks. They're going to trade tips on how to make it work. And I mean, you know, you can put lipstick on a pig. You can. It will work. It's a very important technique of lawyering in society, indeed, to be applying lipstick to pigs. But it works only so long, because the pigs rub it off. And this problem leads people, whether they are consciously willing to admit it or not, to an unconscious fear that they are breaking the unconscious Hippocratic oath of teaching. They do not wish to do harm, and harm is occurring. If they do not wish to do harm and harm is occurring, then your view about what to do about harm will be heard. Yes, I know, they're not going to give back 10% of the tuition. It'd be $50, $90, the Student Senate activity fee, you know. And no, they're not going to insist on a one-day reading period because they'll beg the provost to be, I mean, all this nonsense, right? Symbolic responses. If you really wanted pass-fail grades for everybody this term, and you insisted on that, they would do it. Of course they would do it. Because students are always the force that really insists on grades. And I don't think it's very likely that everybody is going to say, let's just have no grades this term, pass and fail. Because everybody thinks that that's not good for them, because their grades are important, and so you're going to war on the curve, which, as I have said on the pad last week, is mathematically a ridiculous proposition. It's just, the curve doesn't do anything. It's not there to do anything. It's there to provide mystical reassurance against the horrible non-problem of grade inflation. But never mind, because actually, if grades don't matter and jobs don't matter, what does matter? What matters is the quality of your learning. What matters is your feeling about your learning, whether you enjoy it, whether you can feel that the learning you are doing is good for you. That's most effectively dealt with individually by you. Now, it would be good to have some help, and my course is here to have some things to say about that, and I have so many hours to spend editing, writing, and talking to you, and trying to find ways that I, as one teacher, can meet you where you are in order to help you learn what you want to learn, the way you want to learn it, where we exist together. And that's a course, which is one fraction of the total of your load. And I am hoping, of course, that things that happen here between you and me will give you confidence that the learning you want to do in crimes or property or wherever else you are is learning you can do your way and can write about on the exam your way and can have useful and constructive experience with other teachers over. But we can only do that even to the extent that it can be done in this course between you and me, we can only do it to the extent that you can lift yourself out of the anxiety and fear and depression and other forms of negative reinforcement of self coming out of the way the rest of law school is working. You can turn on the road. I cannot turn you. Collectively, you can help one another turn, but only so far in a system which is infected by the social isolation of the epidemic. This, then, is really what makes it hard. It needs you. And it needs the you who is feeling punished by law school, the one that feels like there isn't room for her or him or us anymore. Because law school is such a totalizing experience that I've just got to go with the program of it, which is how organizations function and why men were torn apart by shell on the beach at Gallipoli. And why they're marching, always marching. Talk to you soon.